to Masters Our Domain, the podcast which was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about whatever we feel like doing from week to week. I'm Phoebe Roy, and I am joined as ever by my co-host Patrick Wyman.
Hello, Phoebe. How are you today?
Oh, I'm very good. You may be the eagle-eared among you. Eagle-eared? Is that eagle-eared, right? The bat-eared among you may notice that I am doing the intro, and that is because we killed Milo. We just had enough of the constant quipping, the feck-arsing, the wise guy stuff.
Yeah, we did not need to hear Donald Trump in the labyrinth with the mentor.
No, we didn't need to hear that. We didn't. So we've dealt with the joy boy. He's out. He's gone.
He's actually someplace far worse. He's in Australia.
he's in Australia.
we miss him greatly. I think he and I are currently scheduled to do next week's. While Phoebe, you attend to far more important matters.
Yep.
And so while Milo's in Australia, we'll be mixing up the schedule a little bit. But yeah, I'm confident in saying that there will be no discernible impact on quality, regardless of who's involved.
Basically none. Apart from, of course, me pronouncing 90s as Nankies. So that's something that's
really good. Nobody who's listening to this show for the first time today heard anything other than 90s there.
Exactly. So we try to do the time differences, and it turns out it's literally impossible if you've got one person in Australia, one person in the UK, and one person in the States. So we're just going to be doing it in pairs, but we are doing a new show.
New to us. It's been out for a few years on the Netflixes in the United States. Is it also on Netflix in the UK?
It is, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, it's a co-production between Netflix and a German production company. The show is called Barbarians, and it is about the famous Roman disaster in the Teutoburg Forest in 9 AD, in which three Roman legions were destroyed by a force of Germanic barbarians. A very famous, pretty harrowing event for the Romans, effectively marked the end of organized attempts at expansion into Germania. Mm-hmm. And this is a fictionalized take on it. And, mm-hmm. you know, first impressions, Phoebe, what did you think of this first episode here?
I actually enjoyed it. I didn't think it was bad at all.
It's not bad.
It's not
bad. How crazy is that?
I know. It was almost like, what's happening here?
It was extremely competently done.
It was competently
fun television.
It was very German. I don't know what German TV shows are like normally like, but
takes the film and with competent Germans. The lot of context in which we wish the Germans were not as competent as they historically have been. We could have done with some more incompetence at various stages.
Yeah, I feel like we could have, you know, done with more well-paced TV shows and, you know, less of the other stuff.
Yeah, they did too good a job in what is today Namibia just before World War I. That was German efficiency. That was not the kind of efficiency we're looking for from this show.
No, definitely not. Obviously, I mean, it's got some flaws because, of course, it does. It's a TV show, but I think it's interesting. I think it's an interesting take on a relatively kind of unexplored part of the history of the ancient world. Part of this, of course, is a problem of documentation. A big document from these events is Tacitus's Germania, so that's obviously a Roman perspective. Like whichever way you slice it, this is a Roman perspective. This is what we've got, and I think they do a reasonably good job of trying to invert the lens. I think they do a really like a reasonably good job with that. That, like I said, we got some problems with it. Of course, they got some problems with it. Some of the dialogue.
I would say some of the supporting characters, perhaps not especially well drawn.
There is a little bit, unfortunately, there are two characters who look exactly the same.
Yes.
And unfortunately, these two are romantic rivals. And that makes it quite confusing because they really do look similar.
What I have discovered in recent years, so I grew up in a place that was about 50% Latino, mm-hmm. in Washington State, and I have realized that I have something like face blindness for white people with blonde hair. I just did not spend time around blonde people when I was growing up during my formative years.
This is apparently a known thing though.
Mm-hmm.
It's specifically blonde face blindness.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't feel like reverse racist then. I just I'm part of a broader trend. Walk me through this, Phoebe.
This is a known phenomenon. Whether it's like a legitimate phenomenon, like there's sort of like some kind of either kind of neuroscience or sort of kind of purely kind of acculturated reasoning behind it. I don't know the answer, but I have definitely heard tell of the blonde face blindness.
I think it's a developmental thing. Mm. And kind of the kinds of people that you're exposed to during your periods of like youth development. Mm. So the classic case in the United States is not being able to tell people of Asian descent apart. Because there are just huge swaths of the United States where there are no people of Asian descent living mm-hmm. at all. I grew up in one of them. And so there's this idea that Americans can't tell different varieties of Asian people apart, can't tell individual Asians apart. And it's a problem in the United States with like lots of people think all black people look alike.
But that's just racist, right? Surely.
But I think the manifestations of it are racist. I think the underlying reason for it is that when you're a child and you are surrounded only by white people mm. or you are surrounded like that, because the United States is so racially segregated throughout much of it, that like you can grow up in a place that is technically 50-50 and never meet someone of a different ethnicity at all.
Sure.
But in my case,
you just never met a blonde person.
I knew like one blonde person, and that was easy. If you know one blonde person, you're like, oh, it's the blonde one. Like, you don't have to worry about the face so much. But now I live in Arizona, where in the Arizona suburbs, where it looks like an SS recruiting poster every time you go to a youth sports event. And I'm like, they just all these blonde children running around look the fucking same to me. I can't, even when I'm coaching them and I know them, I have trouble telling them apart.
God, that's fascinating.
So this show, long story short, lots of blonde people. Severe problem for me. They all look alike. I don't know what to do. I'm like, I know that one's a man and that one's a woman, but this one has a beard, but it's the same fucking beard.
It's very similar beard and braid situation.
Yeah.
Also, like, and this is a problem. This is a kind of occupational hazard with any TV show set in the ancient world, which is that you know if you see any kind of idyllic situation, you know something horrible is about to happen. You see like a nice village, you see an angelic child, like mm-hmm. like as soon as like they appear, you're like,
something horrible is going to happen to that.
This is the sense of foreboding. And in this show, they didn't even have the grace to have the that it was literally just like, oh, and it's an idyllic village. Oh, no. What's going to happen to the idyllic village? Something horrible.
That worm turned real quick.
So,
to kind of locate us a little bit here, you mentioned Tacitus's Germania, and that's a fantastic starting point because that is our major written text for understanding the peoples that we tend to lump together and call Germanic. These are so culturally in this period of time, just to go into the historical background,
Yeah, let's situate it.
so we have the Rhine River, right? The Rhine was usually understood in antiquity as marking the border between Germanic speaking peoples and Celtic speaking peoples. Celtic speaking peoples living on the Rhine side. That's not exactly true. There were plenty of Celtic speakers on the far side of the Rhine. There were Germanic speakers moving all over the place, but that's generally understood to be the boundary. Now, Tacitus lumps all of what he calls the Germani together based on language, cultural similarity. We know from other written texts and from the archaeology that these people were often not especially closely culturally related. That there were that that to the that they did not necessarily even recognize a broader identity that the Romans understood as Germani. That like if you had asked people of these different tribes like Cherusci, Chatti, Suebi, all of these different groups, like what they had in common with their neighbors, they would have been like, fuck all, fucking nothing. Like I'm not a Chatti. Like that's not it. So the idea of Germania, Germani, Germanic peoples is very much an outside imposition. This is, and when we're thinking about Tacitus's text and using it as a guide to understanding these people, on the one hand, it's what we've got, and Tacitus did probably talk to people who had been to Germania and knew people that would have fallen under that blanket heading of Germani. But Tacitus was also writing a very straightforward allegory about things he didn't like about Rome. And so his portrait of the Germani is very much a kind of a funhouse mirror view of Roman society and the tendencies and traits that he didn't like among Rome's senatorial elite. So when he's talking about the freedom of the Germani and things like that, which come up all the time in this text, that's really a commentary on what he thinks of as the shortcomings of Rome's political culture, not like, oh yeah, all the Germani were running around, free men doing free things. Like you can't really take it that way. So it's an inter so it's a it, but it's a fascinating text because nobody in antiquity read it. It was not a popular text. I think it only survived in one or maybe two manuscripts that were known up into the 15th, 16th century. But the Germania became very popular in early modernity, and then especially with the Enlightenment, as German-speaking people in Europe wanted to find their own history to hold up against the Roman model. So the Germania became kind of the cornerstone foundational text for modern German-speaking Europeans to understand their past.
And this is really important as well because, like, whenever we're talking about the reception of the ancient world, we're talking about something very specific, and it's always inflected by context. So, I think a pretty kind of like average table stakes bit of knowledge is, oh well, the ancient Greeks had democracy, right? That, like, if you ask somebody, like, tell me some stuff about ancient Greece, one of the things they'll say is, oh, they invented democracy. Democracy, or a putative democratic arrangement, is an aberration in among the Greek city states. It was a weird thing that the Athenians did for a very, very short period of time.
And the Greek, I love that you said that because you know what the ancient Greeks also invented? Tyranny.
Tyranny. They
Like,
loved
sure.
it. They loved that shit.
They invented tyranny way before they invented democracy. And tyranny was a way longer lasting political tradition in the Greek world than democracy
Way
was.
longer, way longer. And then, but that is what is that's what's come down to us. Like, there's the only real reason we have, like, great swathes of like the Latin literary tradition is because, like, it was revived and used as like a grammar textbook for school kids. Like the inheritance of understanding of the ancient world is so arbitrary, and it's so luck-based, and it is so filtered through the context of whatever of who whatever and whoever it is that is looking at it and thinking about it, that that it should be really, really fruitful ground to make a fun TV show. Like that's
it's,
like,
yeah. It's a fun melange of things.
It's a fun melange.
You don't have to be that. You have a lot of freedom to play with the material.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I feel like I'm qualified to do this. I've passed my qualifying exams in ancient history. I'm qualified to teach this to graduate students. They have my go ahead to play around with the material. Mm. I am giving all of them permission to play with it. Yeah. Because as historians who work on this and argue about it and know the texts and know the archaeology, it is... doing the Germanic speaking peoples, doing barbarians, is an inherently difficult task.
It's still your best fucking guess. It's like, I'll tell you what it's like. Like you ask some idiot who is like kind of marketing therapy speak on Reels, like how the human brain works. And they'll say something about how, oh, well, there are incorrect and correct ways to store a memory. You ask a neurologist who has spent their entire life studying the brain, they're like, I don't know.
Yeah. It is all the midwit meme. Mm. Everything is the midwit meme.
Everything is the midwit meme, that's true.
The different, like, there is a vast middle ground where you can make things very complicated and technical and precise, but the idiot and the scholar come to the same conclusion, yeah. Which is like,
we don't know. We just don't know. Yeah. When it comes to any kind of barbarian people in the ancient world, and obviously I use that term extremely loosely. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much your best guess. Like the dumbest person you know, and the most informed about this subject person you know will come to the same. Yeah, like Pat just said, will come to exactly the same conclusion, which is,
because. Yeah, and I'll give you some concrete examples of this that I think will shed some light on this show, right? If you're trying to do your background research to present a convincing portrait of life beyond the Roman frontier in Germania in the first century AD. Mm. So we have Tacitus's Germania. We have quite a lot of archaeology. Like, this is a pretty well excavated area, but the remains that exist from that period are, I would say, pretty bland. There's a lot of settlement archaeology, but they weren't building in stone. So what you have are stains in the dirt of post holes. So when the barbarian village that they present, that is about as accurate as you can possibly hope to get. Mm. Like this, the village that they present, that is dead to rights. You could have drawn it from a site report of one of the many settlements from this period that have been excavated. 100% accurate. Yeah. We can probably be fairly certain that Germanic speaking peoples worshipped a pantheon of gods that of which we see some reflections later in Norse myth. So they probably had a chief god called Woden. That's reconstructible into the Proto-Germanic, Proto-West Germanic, the various varieties of Germanic that we see around this time. We can be fairly certain of that. We can be fairly certain about the material culture, things of that nature. But there are huge swaths of Germanic society that we really struggle to understand, mm-hmm. like how the politics worked, how hierarchical the society was. These are all things that are very difficult for us to grasp because the way that they're presented in the texts always have some valence for Romans,
yeah.
who are reading them. And you can't be sure whether it's an accurate report or whether it's just designed to make the Romans feel bad about the stupid shit that they're doing. Like that's always the hard thing. Same's true when you get later and you're talking about the people who are talking about barbarians. Like there's always a reason why they bring them up. There's always a reason why they present them that way. And only rarely does that have something to do with what the barbarians themselves actually thought, said, believed, you know.
Yeah. So did. we have the external account. We have the archaeology. We have some of their surf pop music. We've got Whoa Whoa Woden. That's something that we have.
Yeah, I really liked the Pixies cover of that.
Yeah, it's a classic for a reason. And also we have, you know, we have evidence of, you know, the '89 World Cup with the post holes. It was actually really sweet. You know, they downed spears and the Romans and the Germans
Yeah. Marco Reus had a brace.
Yeah.
Like he's still playing.
Yeah. This all took place on Christmas Eve, and they were like, what day is it? This means nothing to me.
I think given those limitations, that these are inherent limitations if you're trying to understand this period and these people, I think they've really done a pretty good job.
I think they've done a pretty good job. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, okay, so one thing that, like, I can't let this slide without slagging off Tacitus.
Well, we can slag off Tacitus.
We can slag off Tacitus. He is my MK Ultra trigger phrase. I hear Tacitus and I'm like, it's time for me to slag him off. Now the big thing about Tacitus that you need to be aware of, he's a senator, obviously, because most Roman historians are. You're not gonna find like a historian who's just like, you know what, this guy's just like, he just hangs out. He hangs out in taverns and he's decided to write history. You're from the senatorial class. That's where you're getting your historians from. And Tacitus is writing at a very, very particular inflection point in Roman history, which is that we have an emperor who you may be familiar with from those about to die. We have an emperor. His name is Domitian. Now, Domitian, I am a hardened Domitian apologist. He wasn't that bad. He really, really wasn't that bad, like, particularly, like, compared to some of the other emperors. Obviously, like, no Roman emperor is like a kind of stand-up guy. None of them are like hanging around the tavern. But
all did a lot of mass murder.
They all did There's a lot no of ma- around, they all did a lot of mass murder. And Domitian did some mass murder as well. But his big target was the senators, and that was pretty foolish of him considering where all the historians come from. So Domitian is assassinated in a palace coup. This is relevant, I promise you. Domitian is assassinated in a palace coup, and he is replaced by the people who orchestrated the palace coup. He is replaced by an incredibly old guy called Nerva, who is like just old as fuck in a kind of a, I'm pretty sure, in a world with no sanitation, you should not have survived. How are you so, like, what? Are you? What are you, Nerva?
Very, very, like, the conclave couldn't decide on who the next guy should be, so we're going with the one that we think will die soon, just to buy ourselves
just the
some
oldest
time.
Guy. Yeah, he's a placeholder. He's a placeholder emperor. He's a placeholder pope. The conclave, they're passing their little bitchy notes around there being like, Nerva's so old. Why is he so old? We're ancient.
Okay, now I really want to see a vaping senator in the background. In the background of the Curia.
We're ancient Romans. Really, how is he so old? I've never seen a man this old. So Nerva got given the placeholder pope spot, the placeholder pontifex, if you like, on the understanding that he would be adopting a new young buck coming up out of Spain, big general, loved tall things, big kind of like, you know what? I see this little post. Can you make it a little bit higher?
There's a lot we could say about how Trajan felt about his genitalia and compensating for it.
You could say it. You could say it.
Pretty could say it. Not going
not
to.
The pur- not not us. The purpose of this episode. Not the purpose of this episode.
If you are interested in that topic, Google Trajan's column. Tell me what you think.
Check out our bonus material on our other network, Axes of Attraction, and we do have an entire episode there about the probable size of Trajan's penis, and that's something which you can check out should you desire. So Nerva adopts Trajan. He's going to be the next emperor. Now, you do not get to be a senator of Tacitus's position unless you have been advanced by the emperor. Like, at this point, like, nobody is under any illusions. The Republic's not coming back. No one's going around being like, oh no, this is the Princeps. He's just the first citizen. He's just like you or me. He falls off a bar stool in the tavern like anyone else. Everyone has just admitted that this is not the case by this point. So you have in this period, you have a number of prominent Roman authors, all of whom have had their early career leg up under Domitian. And they've got to pretty hastily disavow that. And they can't do it in an embarrassing way. They can't be like, oh yeah, so remember that guy, Domitian, who had a damnatio memoria, so technically we're not allowed to mention him. Well, you know how, like, he gave me my job? Like, I, like, took it as, like, as, like, a joke. I was, like, being, like, I was, like, yeah, I was making really fun of him, actually.
You really can't do the, like, chest tap, my bad.
Sorry.
You need something a little subtler.
I was like doing it to like mess with him. But this guy, I actually really like this guy, and this guy is the guy. So they have to do something a bit more subtle, and this is what Tacitus does. In the annals, the account of Tiberius is like particularly hostile, and this is meant to make you think of Domitian, and it's a similar context that he's approaching the Germania in. He's trying to kind of put the boot in to Roman political culture without drawing attention to the fact that he's a fucking snake. Mm-hmm. This is how we end up with the noble savage framing of the Germania.
Yeah, and I think this, it's complicated, right? Because we know from the archaeology, other textual reports, it makes it clear that there are internal political hierarchies in the Germanic speaking world, if we want to call it that, mm-hmm. in the world of people that we label Germanic beyond the frontier. I know that's a clunky construction, but I just want to be sure that we're not lumping these people together as some sort of cultural whole. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the cardinal sin that you can commit with barbarians in general, and especially with the barbarian peoples that we often call Germanic. The Goths had nothing to do with the Franks. They were entirely dissimilar in a bunch of different ways, and yet because they both spoke Germanic languages, they get lumped together in the scholarship and in popular culture. I fucking hate it. It bothers the shit out of me.
And they hated it too. They're like, I'm not a Frank. Ew. Don't call me a Frank.
Yeah, these big, especially the larger ethnic labels, are a product of like the third, fourth, fifth centuries AD. They are, even in that period, what they mean is constantly in flux. Who gets to be, count themselves as a Goth, who gets to have that mantle. In the fifth century, there's a point where the probable king of the Franks is actually a Roman general. Mm. The guy calling himself king of the Franks, a guy named Aegidius, who is probably king of the Franks, is also just the Roman field commander in central Gaul. So like, this stuff is complicated. It's not straightforward. Like, there are Romans and there are barbarians and the barbarians are Germans. And like, it's weird. So
this is also where you get the goth emo split.
It's true. Yeah. Yeah. This is the original schism. And so it's hard for us to really make sense of these people on their own terms. Mm. But to bring it back to the actual show that we're watching, yeah. I think they took a pretty good crack at
it. They do. And they are like extremely specific that there is a huge amount of variation among the German people.
That these people don't like each other.
Yeah, they hate each other. There's a great bit when they're at the folk moot, when all the tribes are trying, where like one guy is trying to get all the tribes to unite and agree, and they like, and they're just like calling each other like, well, they're just calling each other like goat fuckers. It's great.
Which, accurate, again, nailed it.
And I think this is interesting as well, because it also tells you quite a lot about the Roman conception of Romanness, which is by its nature, as at least a part of like the, I don't even want to say soft power. It's like the kind of the medium density power, like the jelly power. Mm-hmm. It's not the hard power, but it is the, but it's the kind of the cultural glue that's holding it all together, which is that there is sort of a unified theory of Romanness. If you're a Roman citizen, you're a Roman. That's it. Bosh, there's no real fucking about with it. There's still sort of just about such a thing as like Latin rites and like kind of the subjugated Italian peoples, but functionally, the way that the empire spreads culturally is through this, like, well, either you're a Roman or you're not. You're a Roman or you're a barbarian. These are the two options. You have salty water, and which is the sea, and you have still water, which is a pond. Those are the two options.
Yeah, and you can't. And if you are a salty barbarian, you can desalinate, and you can become Roman.
Exactly.
You can pass through the desalination.
You can have the purification tablet, and then you're safe to drink.
Yeah, because this is really, really important to understand about the ancient world is that Romanness is not inborn, and ethnicity is not inborn in the way that modern people often assume that it is. Yeah. Ancient people, there are some exceptions, but by and large, ancient people did not have a biological conception of ethnicity. Mm. And especially not the Romans, where legal status and ethnicity were divorced from each other so early on. Mm. The split between Roman citizenship as a legal status and ethnic Romanness happened so far in the past, as far as the characters in this show are concerned, that it is beyond the bounds of time. It happened in the 4th century BC. So it is a core thing that makes the Romans who they are and makes the Roman Empire what it is that you can become Roman just by having the legal status and by acting like a Roman, by wearing the right clothes, by cutting your hair the right way, by talking the right way, by eating the right foods. You are Roman. Mm. It's that simple. And so I love that they have a character who is, we find out at the very end of this episode, is Germanic by birth. He's the son of the Rik, the king, which is a good Germanic term. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely accurate. They called him a Rik. In Gothic, it's Rik, so Rikspotets. It's been like 15 years since I got to use my good Germanic linguistic stuff. I'm using it.
No. I'm extremely excited.
But guys like that, who were taken as hostages, the sons of kings and chiefs, and who were raised in the Roman world, as this man seems to have been. We'll discover more about that soon, I'm sure. That's a real thing. Those are real people. They existed. They had those experiences, and that was the framework within which they operated. Mm. It's like that if you took someone and they did the right things, they were Roman. It's that simple.
And this is what is so weird about the principle behind Gladiator 2, that the direction of travel is like the opposite way around. He does not stay a Roman. He does not consider himself to be a Roman until he gets kind of re-Romanized. And we are not here to talk about Gladiator 2 again, fucking hell.
I want to talk about the rabid baboons again.
I mean, they might have some rabid baboons in this. We don't know. We don't know as yet.
Don't know yet.
So the rough overview of what happens in this episode is we open with the idyllic village. Like, immediately I'm like, oh no, not the idyllic village. And we've learned that a new governor is in town, a man called Varus. This is real. He was the governor at the time, and he is planning on stomping all over a previously agreed upon peace between the Germanic peoples and between this particular Germanic tribe and the Romans. And he is gonna ask for some taxation from these poor people. At a very uncompetitive rate of interest. He's not here to be a good guy. Yeah, you were about to say something.
He's not there to take part. He's there to take over.
He's there to take
quote,
over.
To quote Conor McGregor, who committed slightly less than the Romans.
Allegedly. No, he's been charged. You can say that now.
He has. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. So. Yeah, I don't know how to cover ourselves legally on that one, but y'all get what I'm saying.
I think we can safely move on, actually, from that. So something that I liked that I've made a little note of here is that the Romans are speaking Latin and the Germania are speaking German, and we are not, and obviously they're speaking German because it's a German TV show, but what we're not having is we are not having everyone speaking the same language, and we are supposed to understand that they are speaking a different language, or that they are supposed to kind of obliquely understand each other because how. So we have the actual literal language barrier and kind of failure of understanding between the Romans who show up in this village and the Germans, which I like.
It's such a great storytelling technique.
It is, yeah.
And because like, one of the things that we've talked about a lot when we were talking about chaos and when we were talking about those about to die, and it was something that we really liked about Rome, was it let the world speak for itself. And it, like, you don't have to explain everything. Mm. You don't have to, you don't have to be like, well, in this, you don't understand. We know they don't understand because we hear them speaking different languages.
Yeah.
And it makes the cultural divide really obvious. That's doing a lot of work for us as the viewer and bringing us much deeper into the world without a lot of exposition. Like, there's not a lot of exposition in this episode.
Yeah.
It really kind of dumps you into the world and tells you, okay, have at it, Hoss.
Yeah. And also, like, it doesn't think you're stupid, which is
yes.
Wow, it's quite nice.
Which is so nice. And
it's quite nice. It's quite nice to watch a show where they're not like, you know what? You're a fucking, you know what you are? You are pig shit. You are thick as pig shit. You are a fucking dumb moron. You know what? You know how dumb you are? You know what I'm going to do? Every time this character shows up, I'm going to put his name on the screen because you like that, don't you? You fucking stupid idiot. No, they're like, I'm just going to let you work it out for yourself. And even though that means that that these two characters who do look very similar, you are going to get confused. So maybe you are a moron. However, that's not why.
I would rather that a show let me be a moron on my own terms.
Exactly. That's what we want.
Than force me to reckon with my idiocy.
This is the thing.
Like
the Germanic tribes, I only want to be a moron in a free way. I do not want to be a subjugated moron. I do not want to be a tax-paying moron.
No, a free moron.
A free moron of the land. That's what I want to be.
I as you're saying that, you know the scene in Blazing Saddles where the sheriff goes back after the woman has called him a racial slur on the street, and he's talking to Gene Wilder in the sheriff's office, and he's like, you have to understand, these are simple folk, people of the land, you know, morons. And like, which is just one of those like skeleton key in the lock moments for understanding all of American society, especially, but it has much broader valence. And I think there's a lot to say for that as a means of understanding audiences of TV shows too. Like, but I will say unequivocally, this is not a second screen show.
No.
This is not like Those About to Die where you're kind of like scrolling Instagram and you look up from time to time and you keep track of it. Like,
No. You can't do that. You've got to actually watch it. Not least because it's in German, which I do not speak.
it is fucking subtitled.
And like,
yes.
I mean, this is one thing that always happens to me, which is whenever I watch something subtitled, I am always under the impression, just very briefly, that I can somehow, that I'm like miraculously able to understand the language, and then I look away for 1 second.
I know. Oh my god. Okay, I'm so glad you said that because I did the same thing where I'm like, God, this Latin. I'm really getting it.
You know, it's been a while, but like, I wonder if like, you know, like my German grandmother, I wonder if I have some kind of like inbuilt kind of ethnic memory. I can just understand the gist, and then I literally look down to make a note, and I lost track of what they were saying immediately because I do not understand German, as it turns out, or Latin, which I can read.
Yeah.
But there we go. I can't understand it if someone's speaking it to me.
The spoken Latin in this is really good.
Oh yeah, no,
it
I really
like
really
sounds
it.
Sounds like. Like so often when you get spoken Latin, in anything. It's based on like church Latin,
Yeah, exactly.
like later, like kind of later medieval, Renaissance, modern period church Latin.
Yeah.
This does not seem to be based on church Latin. It seems to be based on
Exactly. Then you get
actual
like
Roman period Latin.
the bitchy palace coup being like, he's speaking vulgate. Ew, vulgate. I don't like vulgate.
So I love spoken Latin. I did a lot of work on Latin linguistics back in the day, and especially on like spoken Latin linguistics and our access to it. It's fascinating because we know that the literary Latin that we read in the text is not how people talked, right? We that there is a that in Latin there is a strong distinction between the rules of written language and how it was portrayed and how people were actually speaking. And but our access to spoken language, to spoken Latin, is obviously pretty limited because when do you get actual recorded speech? Not very often. So the way to reconstruct it is that you look at things like patterns of usage in inscriptions, you look at patterns of misspellings in commonly attested words. You can, and if you have large enough databases of these things, you can kind of see the patterns emerge. And what we know is that spoken Latin was a lot simpler than written Latin. We know that in a lot of ways, it was already on its way to becoming like the Romance languages, in terms of grammatical constructions, even vocabulary too. Like there are a lot of words that remain in use in written classical Latin that nobody said after probably 50 BC. But there are tons of words like that. So if you think about, so the word for sword in Latin, right? There are a couple of different words, but they're like the co most common ones are ensis and spatha. In written text, you
It's all
still see people
Gladius.
talking,
Is it still Gladius in
or
written text?
there, yeah, gladius is usually more of a technical
Sure.
term to refer to that specific short sword if you're talking about a generic sword. But so like nobody spoke the word ensis after like the first century BC. One of the ways that we know that is that ensis has no surviving descendant words in Romance
Yeah, of
languages.
course.
It
Yeah.
just dis it just disappears.
Yeah.
Like they're all based on
It's like
spatha,
a stub
so that
word.
like, yeah, exactly. So it becomes like espada in Spanish, right? So that's one of the ways that we know. But the difference between spoken Latin and classical Latin was full of differences like that.
That's so interesting. I had no idea about that.
And we also know that there were regional varieties of spoken Latin. You would have had a noticeable accent if you were from North Africa versus Spain versus Gaul versus, given it by 250 AD, there was probably a British Latin accent
All right,
that would have
you
been
look
fairly
here. You look
distinctive.
here. This is my insis. You
We
don't
don't say
have
insis here, brother.
anything which you don't have anything which is gonna which can fight against this. So you may as well. You know what? On your bike. On your bike, Germans. Is that what the Germans are? Oh, yeah. Oh, no, have a look. Two World Wars and one World Cup, eh? That is the British Roman.
So this would be such a rich vein to mine at some point, is the guy who wanted to stay Roman in Britain after all of the like while there's Anglo-Saxons showing up and you're like, got some olive oil. Got a shipment.
Oh, he's,
Like what?
listen to him. He's got his. He's on his. On about his. Look, he's got his weird dress thing on again. Tell him to
Yeah,
stop.
why wouldn't he
It's
just wear
so weird.
trousers like a normal
It's so
person?
weird. Have you been in his house? The floors are all hot.
Yeah.
It's so
Hot
weird.
floor.
He's got
Yeah,
a.
like he wants to take a bath. He invited me to take a bath. It was really
It was
strange.
really gay. It was really, really gay of him. That was really gay that he wanted to take a bath with me. He wanted
Was,
me to
but
go and he's got that little he's got that bathroom with like where the tiles are all like kind of tiny. Like they're not like proper sized. They're like tiny little tiles.
it makes a weird picture. It's like a stretched out octopus
It's
type
really
of thing. I don't know
weird.
what to
It's
do with it.
really, really weird of him. No, I haven't answered him either. No. Because if I answer him, then I feel like he's just gonna like keep expecting me to like go to his house and have a bath with
And go in the
him and
bath.
go in
I
the
don't want to
bath with
go in
him.
the
I don't want
bath
to go in the
because
bath with him. It's so weird of him.
It was weird the first time, got weirder the second.
So
Didn't get doesn't get any less
it's
weird.
so weird. It's so weird. Nobody should have that many patterns in their floor. That's such a weird thing to do.
Phoebe, you've got this like somewhere between London and Miami accent going here, and I first of all, I'm fascinated by it. Second of all, I think it's perfect.
Thank
It
you.
real you've really nailed that cultural stratum, I would say.
Cheers.
So we got so Varys shows up. He wants more tribute. He's sending around a spectacularly unpleasant centurion or tribune of some kind, or military
Yeah,
tribune,
he's a piece of
to
shit.
collect this from the
Kind of
villages.
sta
That guy
sort of
sucks.
standard Roman piece of shit.
Yeah, which we'll come back to. Like the kind of one of the big themes of this show from the first episode is like how shitty imperialism is for the people who are doing it.
Yes. Yeah. Which is
Like
re which is
so.
which really interesting, really good. And there is something else which sort of slots into that, which is a note that I made, which is something which I think is very rarely touched on in any kind of culture about the ancient world, which is that there are these extremely subtle social structures and systems of power that have been kind of, built up in kind of delicate ways among the subjugated peoples, and they mean nothing in the face of Roman might. They mean absolutely nothing in the face of swords and horses and tactics and like the kind of the unimaginable centralized power of Roman imperial might. So they so these so the so the Germ this German tribe, they bring out their like their kind of old guy who's played by Santa Claus, and they're like, this is our and they're like
God,
and
he
they're like
fucking does
this
look like
he's
Santa
played by
Claus.
Santa Claus, and they're like, this is our king. It's his last and greatest role. This is our king. And the Romans are pretty much like, all right. Okay,
This fucking
fine,
guy.
cool. Okay, that's your king. Like, we can kill your king in front of you, and it means nothing to us. But it would cause an incredible internal crisis for you, and it doesn't matter. We have no, not just interest in it, but it has like it's ridiculous. It's like. Actually, what's something which is quite fun? They show you what it's like, semiotically, which is that the main young woman in the village is called what's her name?
Who's Nelda?
Susnelda. And you see her, like she's in the thumbnail, she's kind of done up like kind of Mad Max. It's cool, she's cool. She's a bit sassy, she's a little bit sassy. She's been promised to another Reich. She's been promised to the Reich of the Chatty. Rake, sorry, that's how you say it, isn't it?
Reek,
Reek.
reek,
Reek.
usually.
Okay, so she's been promised to the other Reek of the Chatty, but she is having an affair with this young man named Ferquin and the Reek of the Chatty look the same, right down to the fact that they both have a little kind of little plait, and I'm like, at least do his hair different.
Yeah, it would be really hit, like slightly different in color, but I couldn't tell which one was which if you were asking
You're
me.
gonna make this guy look. So, but she's having she is. She has chosen him, but her father has chosen her another groom, and she is not happy about the Romans showing up to insist on this tribute, which they cannot afford. Like they give them everything they've got, and it's still not enough. The Romans are like, nah, we thought there'd be more, and she goes to attack the centurion on the horse, and her angelic little brother. Goes he start like the guy starts like dragging her around by the hair, so her angelic little brother kind of leaps out and tries to save his sister, is obviously killed and then comes back to life, but we'll get to that.
He gets bonked on the head real hard, and I think the idea is he's suffered a traumatic brain injury.
Oh, I
And
thought he's come back. I thought he was supposed to be a little
no, so he
ghosty.
got, yeah, no, he got, so he got bonked on the head. He has a traumatic brain
So they
injury, and
think
he's
he's dead.
not, Yeah, he's alive, but he's clearly not
He's
well.
not
Like
right.
he's,
Okay. Okay, well, fair enough. But like this image of this little boy like flinging himself at the centurion on the horse is a pretty good representation of the subtle structures of internal structures and internal arrangements of this tribe, which are sort of laughable in the face of Roman might.
He does not think twice about bonking the king's son over the Reek's son over the head with the pommel of his sword and rendering him disabled for the rest of his life. Like
Because
it doesn't and this is I'm so glad you pointed that out because that's a fundamental thing here. And there's a bunch of different ways we can approach it, but I think strictly from the storytelling, thematic, making us as people be invested in this world, it's so fucking effective. And this specifically the scene you're talking about, because it's an image. It's like I remember the specific image of the guy on the horse dragging her by the hair. And you're like, oh, this is not just is this a potent image for us in the context of this series and making us invested in the characters and the story that they're telling, but that is Roman imperialism. It's a guy dragging someone by the hair,
from his horse.
and that is imperialism. That is Roman imperialism. It is shorn of the ideology, shorn of fancy parades, shorn of the triumph, shorn of the magnificence of Rome. That's what imperialism is. It is a guy dragging a woman by the hair and hitting a child over the head with a sword. That's what imperialism
It
is.
is brute. It is brute force. It is the stripping and making use of resources. It's theft, it's murder, it's violence, it's grinding out opposition to it under a hopelessly mismatched hoof.
I want to give an idea here of kind of Roman military capacity in comparison to these people. So I was talking about this recently. I interviewed a historian of like a Roman military historian, basically. His name's Brett Devereaux. Interesting guy. And we talked a lot about Roman military capacity, mobilization, numbers of soldiers, things like that. So Varus here, in both in the show and in actual history, so far as we know, had three legions. That's about 15,000 soldiers, which does not sound like that many soldiers, all things considered. And these Germanic tribes that we're talking about in this region probably could have mustered 15,000 fighting men. The difference is those 15,000 guys that the tribes can muster are all of their fighting men. That is the whole thing. That is every able-bodied man of military age, right? If they lose a battle, not only is the war over, their society is destroyed, right? So now the Romans can lose 15,000 prime age military men, and it sucks. Like it's not good to lose three legions as Augustus running through the palace saying, "Varus, give me back my legions." That's another kind of famous line here. Like, it's not good. You don't want to lose three legions, but it's not a demographic catastrophe for the Roman Empire. It's a military disaster. It's one that you're going to have to work to rectify. It's going to take a lot of time to fix it, but it is not a society destroying thing to lose three legions. In fact, it probably doesn't even compromise the territorial integrity of the Roman Empire. And that's the difference between a Mediterranean spanning political unit and the people, barbarian peoples who are living on the borders.
And also another thing which I think comes up, which I actually have written down. So I'm again very pleased that this has come up, which is it was a huge thing for the Romans symbolically. It was like the symbology of it was just, oh, it's just so embarrassing. It's a bunch of plat guys and a woman and like, oh, they cleaned our clocks for us. That's I can never show my face down the tavern on a Friday night ever again. Not if anyone finds out about that. That's like no one filmed it, right? They didn't. Yeah. No one. No one got. If you got, delete that. Can you delete that? Can I? Is it out of your deleted items as well? Can you give me that?
They didn't really try again. No? Because what they discovered is the in this particular part of the world, it's a lot easier to control a frontier relatively indirectly. Yeah. By doing things like demanding hostages, so you've got these seven different tribes that all hate each other. Like, you just pick one of them and be like, you're our guy. Here's some gold. Here's some swords. Go to town on your opponents, because it's easier to deal with that one guy and make him your kind of proxy beyond the frontier than it is to rule that area directly. Yeah. The Romans were. That was the basis of how the Romans managed their frontiers for several centuries quite successfully, mm-hmm. was through careful management, not so much of what happened on the Roman side, but what happened on the other side. So far beyond the limit of any Roman watchtower, the Romans are still exerting influence on what's happening in the land that they called Barbaricum, the land of the barbarians.
And then this is like a playbook for every kind of functioning imperialist process that comes after. You find one lot of people who you can trust to kind of deal with things on the ground on your behalf, so that you're not expending all of this like energy and manpower on doing it yourself. But what I think is really good and really interesting is that this tension between symbolic defeats and the symbology of the defeat carries with it when you've got so many people that functionally they are disposable, mm-hmm. and that tension between symbology and materiality is expressed very explicitly in this episode, because after this terrible thing that happens, they drag off one of the guys who tries to resist them. They take his head off. They take all this livestock. They clunk the little boy on the head. They drag the woman around by the hair, and so she gets together with her boyfriend, with Thequin, and they steal the standard, because they've forced the Reek to kiss the standard, and they go and steal it because they have correctly understood that this object is invested with far more symbolic meaning than the men that they have sent. This object is more valuable to them than their men, because they've got so many. Whereas the people of the tribe are more valuable to the tribe. And this is something which she kind of correctly understands.
This is, you're 100% right. And the scene where they're forcing the Reek to kiss the standard, or to kiss the eagle, what they have the guy saying, the centurion saying, is Roma Victrix, which the subtitles translate as victorious Rome or something like that. But this is actually a much deeper phrase if you're trying to make sense of the Roman psyche. Mm. There was this idea for the Romans, this really deeply rooted and important idea, that Rome was eternally victorious. Mm. That the essence of Rome was victory, and that the two, in fact, were not separable. That to be Roman was to be victorious. To be victorious was to be Roman. Anything else is a contradiction in terms. And this is a really long-lasting kind of ideology. It lasts through late antiquity and into the Middle Ages. There's a great book by a scholar named Michael McCormick on it that lasts, and he tracks the phenomenon all the way up into, I think, like the 6th, 7th century AD. So this is a really deep-seated idea. It's very important. I think you could go so far as to call it the animating idea of Roman imperialism. And so, like, it is that's not an idle statement when the centurion says that. And attacking the eagle, stealing the eagle, that is so accurate to understanding the kind of symbolic level that imperialism is operating on. I liked this show the first time I watched it. I liked it more when I watched it last night. And now that I'm discussing it with you, I like it even more. Yeah. I'm like, this is...
No, it's good. It's good. It's good.
They did their homework. Yeah.
So the final thing, which is relevant plot wise, like honestly, like There's not that much plot that happens in this episode, but what plot there is, it's very dense. It's very nutrient heavy. It's like a sweet potato.
What? See, of all the things you could have gone with there, why sweet potatoes?
I don't know.
It's like a fine cassava.
It's like a fine cassava. It's a complex carbohydrate. That's what.
Shout out to quinoa, baby.
Shout out to quinoa. We also have a kind of new-ish, youngish commander type who is able to speak German, or rather is able to speak the language of this particular tribe. And he is able to sentence a German tribesman to lashes because he understands him slagging him off. We know that the Reek's sons have been lost to Rome, but this is a little bit of a tricksy statement, because like as soon as that happens, I'm like, and then he shows up on his own without the without either the symbolic or the material protections of Rome around him, and he says to the Reek, "Hello, father." So when he says he's lost his son to Rome, it's that he went off and has been raised as a Roman, as opposed to, as we first assume, that he's killed by Rome. We have another bit where we have this kind of a sort of local kind of wise woman who says that the little boy sort of faced death and has kind of come back from death, and there's a very interesting kind of ritualized scene. So it's not that symbology doesn't matter to them, it's that there is a complex system of rite and ritual which is governing and structuring their life, whereas just like a stupid gold bird on a stick, they're like, ugh, like what's that for? That like, you want your little gold bird back, do you? It feels like your little gold bird is like pretty important to you, so I'm just gonna take that off you. So that's there, and then he shows up and says hello, father, and you're like, oh boy. Now we know.
And what does he say though? What does he say?
He says salve. He
says salve fater.
He does.
So not pater.
He says fater. Yep,
so he says it's combined Latin and German. And that's which I just thought was such a sweet, sweet, sweet little way to finish it. Because it's the last line of the episode. It's so good.
A little bit of fusion, baby. Now we know who this is, right? But we're not going to say who this is.
Yes, we're not going to say who it is.
We'll get to who this is. Right. Okay. Okie dokie. Yeah.
We know who this is. That you, as the audience, can look
can
it up
look
if you
it
want
up
to.
If you. But we can do some dramatic irony because we are professionals. And therefore we know who this is supposed to be. that's always really fun. Like whenever like you're watching a kind of TV show which is based on sort of like kind of any kind of historical event, how the spoilers work. Because like I've never had a good handle on how that works. Like I remember a long time ago, I got properly told off on Twitter for posting what they deemed to be a spoiler from The White Queen, and I was like, a spoiler? It happened. What do you mean a spoiler?
It's just historical events.
What do you mean a spoiler?
You can look up the Wikipedia page for Jacquetta Woodville if you want. Like that's a real person. Yeah. She existed.
What's the spoiler? Sorry, is it news to you that Edward IV died? Because even if he hadn't died within the bounds of this TV show, you assume that he died at some point, right?
I certainly hope so, because otherwise we're dealing with a
very, very, very old king. And that gives more grist to the mill of my new bit, which is being like an ultra royalist, but also claiming that the legitimate line ended after the death of Richard III. I'm like, it's like it's House of Plantagenet for me.
I suppose you could make an argument that Edward VIII, given his fondness for drinking, eating, and fucking, could well have been the reincarnation of Edward IV.
Yeah.
A lot of overlap.
Yeah,
there.
More of a Nazi than I reckon Edward IV would have been. Edward IV was more a kind of joke.
Wait, Edward VII? Who was the big one who liked to fuck? Was that Edward VII or Edward? That was Edward VII.
Yeah,
sorry,
there isn't an Edward VIII. I don't think.
Yeah, Edward the Seventh.
Yeah, that's embarrassing. Yeah.
The one who had the comfy sex chase lounge built for himself to accommodate his girth.
Yeah, that's
Edward the Seventh. Yeah.
I just know about him being a Nazi.
No, that's Edward the Eighth. That's the one who.
So which one's Edward the Seventh? Who the hell's that?
Queen Victoria's son, the large lad, with a beard. Liked cigars, very, very stout gentleman. Preceded George V, died in, I want to say, 1910.
So is there like a whole king, who I don't know about?
Say, he didn't.
All right, you know what?
He wasn't king for very long. It was 1901 to 1910.
All right, you know what, Pat? I don't do this very often, but I am going to have to get out my ruler. Let's have a little look here. Let's have a little look on the ruler. Oh my god, you know what? Bang on with the dates as well. Look, this is not my period, all right? This is not my period of history.
Okay, well then I get to fill you in about a British king. Because yes, he was a very large man, was not bad looking in his youth, but he put on a lot of weight while he was waiting for Queen Victoria.
I see. And she took her time about that as well.
She really did. So by the time he became king, he was already quite advanced in age. He may have been the first one to get the Royal Navy tattoo, like all the royals do.
You know what? I'm not.
He might have been the first.
You know what? I'm not happy about my ruler. That's interesting. But I've just suddenly clocked something here. You know who we don't have on my ruler? We do not have Jane Grey. And I think that's an error. I think Jane Grey should be on there. Edward V's on there.
Hey, he was a poor Edward. A poor excuse for an Edward.
Yeah. Fucking Perkin. Whatever.
Yeah, so... Yeah, anyway. big guy liked to fuck... he genuinely was so fond of sex that he had a special like chaise lounge made to accommodate him that would allow him to comfortably have sex without having to do anything. It's a remarkable contraption. But so if Edward IV had somehow survived, he would have been Edward VII. A lot of overlap.
Okay. Yeah. Also played by Santa.
Yeah, could have been played by Santa.
In one
of
his more kind of voluptuary-based roles.
A big shocker to the youths when they saw Santa Claus in that role.
It's an important rite of passage. Like, you stop believing in Santa when you see him playing Edward VII, kind of lolling around on his sex sofa.
Yeah, just spilling out of a waistcoat. Like, that really...
Spilling out of a waistcoat. I think that's everything. I feel like we
that was your turning point in today's episode. I broke you with spilling out of a waistcoat.
You did.
That would be reasonable. Yeah. Well, I'm very excited about this series though. I think we're gonna have a lot
I'm
of
excited.
Fun.
I'm excited. I think we're gonna have a lot of fun. And I'm excited to find out who this mysterious man is with the Mark Zuckerberg haircut. I am excited to find out who this is. I don't know why I'm doing this voice. I don't know what this voice is supposed to be.
I'm going to say Slavic expatriate.
Fine. Slavic expatriate, if you like.
Like white Russian who spent the 20s in Paris.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. All right. Why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. Okay.
So I believe this was a bonus episode. So thank you very much for subscribing. You're the best. Next week, it will be Milo and Pat. They will probably do this explanation again, just in case you are a freeloader. If you are, you won't be listening to this because that's the way this thing works. But
that's the gentlest use of freeloader I think I've ever heard in my life.
But until next time, thank you very much for listening.
See you guys later.
Bye.